compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
And away we go. Hour two is here. Thanks for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. My number is 888-914-9149. You can call now, get you on the air quickly. 888-914-9149. This is being reported in the New York Post. Actually, there are two things that are being reported right now. One of the editors at the New York Post, Sohrab Amari, I just retweeted this. This is what he tweeted a few minutes ago. He says, I have early word that after a seven-month probe, the Manhattan district attorney has declined to charge Father George Rutler in any way in response to the sex assault accusation against him. If this is confirmed, Catholic commentators who presumed Father Rutler's guilt must be held accountable. And then a follow-up to that tweet, he says, I distinctly remember insisting on Father's right to a presumption of innocence, while a number of Catholic figures jumped the gun and, in one especially awful case, retweeted a tweet that prejudged him guilty. And I remember seeing some things like that as well on Twitter. So this is good news. It's not definitive, but it is good news in the right direction, if you ask me. And I have always admired Father George Rutler and his writings. And so this didn't seem to add up to me. And if you want to know the details, just Google his name and you'll find them. But in any case, I wanted to bring this to your attention as soon as I saw it, and I just saw it a matter of minutes ago. So once again, the Manhattan district attorney has declined to charge Father George Rutler in any way in response to the allegations that were made against him. And I think that's very good news. This also, unrelated in any way to Father Rutler, this is an article by Sohrab Amari, and he is talking about Facebook's lab leak sensors. Now, you're saying, what is a lab leak sensor? Well, what it refers to is how over the last many months, Facebook would censor, it would ban any kind of posting of anybody on Facebook that might suggest that the coronavirus was man-made. So the situation, as he points out, is evolving. So Sohrab Amari says, gee, thanks. The flip-flop comes more than a year after the social media giant banned a well-reasoned post-opinion column by China scholar Stephen Mosher that speculated about a potential lab leak. So we're talking about the Wuhan lab and the novel coronavirus that has wreaked havoc on the world ever since early last year. So Amari says, will our columnist receive an apology? Of course not. But it's the American people who should be holding the Menlo Park tyrants to account, referring to Facebook. Think about it. If you were Xi Jinping and you wanted to deploy an information control operation over the origins of COVID-19, you couldn't have done better than just to let Facebook, working in conjunction with America's bottom-feeding fact-checking industry, and fact-checking is in quotation marks, you couldn't do better than just to let Facebook and the fact-checkers do their thing. The Chinese communists, after all, were held in odium in the USI long before the first COVID cases arrived. How much more effective and devious to have a gazillion-dollar U.S. tech firm shut down public inquiry into the virus's origins, and that with the help of the well-credentialed quote-unquote experts and quote-unquote fact-checkers. It's worth returning to what Mosher wrote to see how shameful Facebook censorship was. For starters, note that Stephen Mosher didn't definitively claim that COVID-19 had leaked from a lab. What he argued, rather, is that a lab leak should be plausible to anyone familiar with Chinese realities. Among the pieces of evidence he marshaled include the fact that Xi himself had, in the early days of the crisis, warned about lab safety as a national security priority. And that's referring to the president of China. Also, the fact that following Xi's guidance, the Chinese Ministry of Science and Technology released a new directive titled Instructions on Strengthening Biosecurity Management in microbiology labs that handle advanced viruses like the novel coronavirus. Cyrus, why on earth couldn't they get an acronym out of that? It would have been like a German word, 50 letters long. Instructions on strengthening biosecurity management in microbiology labs that handle advanced viruses like the novel coronavirus. So that was a directive that was issued by the Chinese Ministry of Science and Technology before this broke out or before the outbreak. Also, Stephen Mosher pointed out that above all, the fact that the Middle Kingdom has only one level 4 microbiology lab that can handle deadly coronaviruses, and that lab just happens to be located at the center of the epidemic. So Amari points out, he says, set aside any other scientific questions about the virus, many remain unresolved. Didn't it at least merit some thought that the country's sole coronavirus lab is located at the outbreak's ground zero? Even if Mosher were wrong, and a growing number of U.S. security officials and top scientists are coming around to his side, didn't Americans and their policymakers have the right to consider the possibility? The virus's true origins, after all, would inform any number of concrete decisions, not least whether Beijing and the curiously Beijing subservient World Health Organization deserved U.S. cooperation. But no. Facebook and its quote-unquote experts knew better and moved to suppress a vital column, distorting the U.S. debate when it mattered most. Oh, about those quote-unquote experts whose testimony was used to justify the ban, one of them at least, Danielle E. Anderson, an assistant professor at Duke NUS Medical School in Singapore, regularly collaborated with the Wuhan virologist, hardly an unconflicted source. Another quote-unquote expert insisted that no responsible government would permit such deadly leaks, and the quaint assumption that China ranks among responsible governments was enough to merit banning Mosher's column, to her mind. Similarly, dubious expert claims amplified by partisan quote-unquote fact-checking outlets like PolitiFact were used to frame as conspiracy nuts anyone who dared warn of a potential lab leak. PolitiFact has now quietly taken down its denunciation of Tucker Carlson as a leading conspiracy theorist on this issue. I like Tucker Carlson. The pattern of big tech censorship enabled by an unaccountable fact checkers poses a catastrophic danger to America's ability to govern herself and to respond to crises. The problem isn't just that it leaves ordinary Americans in the dark, but that it insulates elites themselves from uncomfortable realities, such as the possibility that their beloved Chinese trading partner might be responsible for a pandemic that cost millions of lives. Oddly enough, he finishes, Facebook and the other big tech giants are irreformable. Only political action in the form of removing the special status that allows them to act like publishers without any of the traditional publishers' liabilities can save us from this private tyranny. That is good. So things are changing yet again, and the evidence seems to be emerging in a way that is, at the very least, gaining the attention now of some of the very people who tried to ban it, like Facebook. And now they're being forced into the situation of having to evaluate it and consider whether or not, in fact, this may have come from China. In fact, it might have come intentionally from China. And if you had put that on Facebook a week ago, it could have gotten you banned. Same with Twitter. These people are ruthless. And if you put something on there that they don't like, they will deplatform you so fast your head will spin. 888-914-9149. Let's get back to the phones. Jimmy in Wisconsin, thank you for waiting and welcome. Hello, Jimmy.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, I can.
Okay. In addition to your conversation with the guy on earlier, in marriage, is it a sin to just be abstinent? And then, because then you're not having any kids.
Well, do you mean if a couple decides that they're going to practice NFP forever and never engage in the marital act?
Correct, never engage, yeah.
Well, it would be, I don't know that I would say it would be a sin, because it would depend upon what the reason is. So if you're talking about 2 80-year-olds and that is just not part of their marriage anymore, obviously that's not a sin. If the husband or the wife has bad health, and because of that, they feel that this is not something that they can engage in, that's not a sin. But I think where it could become sinful is if you have a couple who's young and there are no mitigating factors like health or other problems, and they just don't want any children at all. It would be sinful if they enjoyed the benefit of the marital act and then refrained during the fertile times of the month with the intention of never having children. I would say that would be sinful. That would be a contraceptive mentality. And I don't say that on my own accord. I would say I think that's a faithful interpretation of what Pope Paul VI wrote in his document Humanae Vitae. I mean, you can see it in other places, but that would be a landmark place. And then if there were a couple that said, we, for whatever reason, we don't want children, but they refrained from the marital act completely, that to me seems like it probably wouldn't be a sin. Their motives would have to be evaluated. I mean, they would have to do the evaluating. And if the motives were selfish, and the motive was, well, we just want a bigger house, or we want better vacations, or we want whatever that's not really on par with the gift of God giving them the gift of children, I'd say that could be sinful insofar as it would be a contraceptive mentality. But more so, it would be more sinful, in my view at least, if the couple were enjoying that benefit of marriage, except for the fertile times, and they just never intended to have any children at all. I would see that that would be a problem. Is that the kind of thing you're describing?
Yeah. And I think you answered it mostly there. What if it's one partner is just uninterested in denying the other, then would there just be sin on one part and not on the other part, or on both?
I want to make sure I understand the question. So you're saying, let's say that one spouse, re-say it. I want to make sure I'm understanding your question.
One spouse just simply chooses to be abstinent and deny the other, and the other is not interested in living that way.
Oh, okay.
On both sides, or just the one, because it's...
Mm-hmm. Well, part of this dimension of the sacrament of holy matrimony involves the mutual self-giving. And when the parties marry, they exchange consent. So the vows include the exchange of consent, meaning that I fully and freely and permanently, until death do us part, I fully and freely give myself to you, and you have rights over me, and I have rights over you. Not tyrannical rights, you know, not the rights of, you know, it's like a slave owner or anything like that, but they're mutual. So it would be sinful if the husband, let's say, were to say to his wife, I'm not interested in this anymore, and just fail or refuse to render what the theologians refer to as the marital debt. That would be a sin for him. So if he said, I'm not interested anymore, and I'm not going to render this to you, even, you know, you're asking for this, but I'm not going to do this, that would be a sin. That'd be a serious sin. I don't know how often that happens in real life, but the church has said that that would be sinful, because the wife and the husband both have the right to this under, you know, normal circumstances. If the wife just has a baby and the following day the husband is demanding his marital rights, that is not acceptable, and he has no right to demand that, because it is I don't have to explain why. So my point is that under normal, reasonable circumstances, the debt is to be granted. But in any given couple, you know, every couple is going to be somewhat different. That's the kind of thing where between the two of them, they would have to work through that, maybe with a marriage counselor.
So let's say that scenario exists, and then the one just is just flat out going to deny the other the rest of their life, and they just don't like them anymore, not interested, fell out of love, however you want to say it. Is that grounds for an annulment? Or no?
Well, in itself, no. So let's posit this, first of all, that an annulment is not, the church doesn't annul a valid marriage. Rather, what the church does is determine in this process of investigation that the marriage was null from the beginning. So in a case like that, that you're describing with this refusal on the part of one of the parties, it doesn't affect the validity of the marriage, because nothing that happens after the marriage affects its validity. It would only be something that's present or in place at the time of the marriage, before it and leading up to that marriage. If there's something amiss there, if there were some impediment that could have prevented this marriage from being valid, then that's what the church would determine. But nothing that happens after the couple is married and have consummated the marriage, nothing that happens after that in any way affects the validity of the marriage.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. These are important questions. So if you're asking for a friend, I hope you'll give him some encouragement that he should ask for God's grace and assistance to work through this problem. It can be resolved, but it will take some grace to come into this.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Jimmy. Good to talk to you. 888-914-9149. We have more phone calls to get to, but I think maybe we should wait just a little bit because we have a break coming here in just a minute. I don't know if you have been following the news in Israel, but it looks as though the conflict between Israel and Hamas has died down for a time anyway. I wonder if, to what extent it's going to flare up again. I certainly hope it doesn't. But I thought you might want to know from the Times of Israel, several major Jewish organizations in the U.S. have been encouraging the Biden administration to take action against anti-Semitism, including appointing a monitor at the Department of Homeland Security and naming a liaison with the Jewish community, given the uptick in anti-Semitic attacks that have been breaking out all around the world, but especially in these United States, we're seeing more of this. Representatives from five organizations met with White House officials on Monday to discuss the suggestions as well as other issues in the wake of a sharp spike in anti-Semitic attacks that came amid renewed violence between Israel and the Gaza Strip. Among the names that have been suggested as a monitor of anti-Semitism are the former Anti-Defamation League leader Abraham Foxman, and there's a long list of people here that are being considered, or at least their names are being raised. The groups that sent the letter and were represented at the meeting, in addition to the Jewish Federations of North America, were the Orthodox Union, the American Jewish Committee, and the Anti-Defamation League. The White House, for its part, did not comment, and the three Jewish officials who returned the Jewish Telegraphic Agency's calls did not feel comfortable going into details of what the White House officials said or naming even who was present. The participants said that each of the five requests that they made was addressed during the meeting, nominating an anti-Semitism monitor at the State Department, naming a Jewish liaison, convening a summit on anti-Semitism, adding funds to secure nonprofits, and keeping in place an executive order by former President Trump that combats anti-Semitism on campuses. So we'll see what's happening here, but we have to speak out against violence in all its forms, violence against any particular group, and that includes Jews. So to the extent that Jews are being targeted and harassed and harmed, we've seen this before. We don't have to, we don't have to look very far to see what happens when people are scapegoated like that. We have to stand up and speak out against it. So I offer you that little update in case this is something that you see. Maybe you can raise your voice to help other people know about this and do what we can to stop it. 888-914-9149 is the number. We're going to take a break and come back, and I'm going to share with you some statistics from a recent survey about how many people in this country would like to see the country run on more biblically oriented principles. We'll break that down in a variety of ways. You might be surprised what the statistics say. And I'll give you that when we come back from this quick timeout. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, there's a line open, so now is your opportunity to ask Patrick a question by calling 888-914-9149.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right, we are back. Man, I feel like I'm in the 70s. So what the 70s sounded like, everybody, those of you who weren't around in those days.
You still have bell bottoms?
I don't have any anymore.
But you did.
I couldn't fit into them even if I did, if I had kept them. But I used to wear them. I used to wear, in the mid-1970s, I think this was popularized by a certain Robin Williams, who was in Mork and Mindy. Remember that TV show?
I loved Mork and Mindy when I was a kid.
Well, he used to wear rainbow suspenders back when rainbow suspenders didn't mean anything. And I used to wear rainbow suspenders. And they didn't. The rainbow didn't mean anything.
If anyone has a picture of this, please send it to...
Yeah,
me. I want. Okay,
are you me in bell bottoms and rainbow suspenders. If you had seen me in the mid-70s, you might easily have seen that. Okay, so back to business. And the number, by the way, 888-914-9149. This is from Pew Research. Half of Americans say, this might surprise you, half of Americans say the Bible should influence U.S. laws. including 28% who favor it over the will of the people. You're saying, what? Here are the results. The U.S. Constitution does not mention the Bible, God, Jesus, or Christianity, and the First Amendment clarifies that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Still, some scholars have argued that the Bible heavily influenced America's founders. Well, of course it did. In their own writings, they say that it did. That's kind of a dumb thing to say. Today, Pew says, about half of Americans, 49%, say the Bible should have at least some influence on U.S. laws, including nearly a quarter, 23%, who say it should have a great deal of influence. This according to a recent Pew Research Center survey. Among U.S. Christians, two-thirds, or 68%, want the Bible to influence U.S. laws at least some. And among white evangelical Protestants, this figure rises to about 9 in 10, or 89%. At the other end of the spectrum, there is broad opposition to biblical influence on U.S. laws among religiously unaffiliated Americans, also known as religious nones, N-O-N-E-S. They identify as atheistic, agnostic, or nothing in particular. Roughly three-quarters in this group say the Bible should hold little to no sway, including 86% of self-described atheists who say the Bible should not influence U.S. legislation at all. Well, there's no getting around it. There are things in the Bible that do indeed influence U.S. legislation, like thou shalt not kill. I mean, it's in the Bible. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness. So, I mean, you can't entirely expunge the biblical influence on our laws, but some people, I think, would like to see them. Two-thirds of U.S. Jews as well think the Bible should not have much or should have no influence on laws. There also are differences on this question by age and political party, as you might imagine. Older Americans are much more likely than younger Americans to want biblical influence on U.S. laws, while Republicans, by a 2-to-1 margin, are more likely than Democrats to do so. All survey respondents who said the Bible should have at least some influence on U.S. law were asked a follow-up question. When the Bible and the will of the people conflict, which should have more influence on U.S. laws? The more common answer to this question is that the Bible should take priority over the will of the people. This view is expressed by more than a quarter of all Americans, or 28%. About 1 in 5, 19%, say the Bible should have at least some influence, but that the will of the people should prevail. Two religious groups stand out for being especially supportive of biblical influence in legislation, even if that means going against the will of the American people. That is, two-thirds of white evangelical Protestants, 68%, say the Bible should take precedence over the people, and half of black Protestants say the same. Among Catholics, 25%, and white Protestants who do not identify as born again or evangelical, that's 27%, and only about a quarter share this perspective. And lastly, the survey did not ask people what they had in mind when thinking of biblically influenced laws. It's possible some were thinking of biblical marriage, defined by some Christian leaders as marriage between one man and one woman. You notice that they say, well, some Christian leaders say that. The overwhelming majority of Christian leaders say that, guys. Come on, Pew. The overwhelming majority of Christian leaders say this. There are some outliers. I'm sorry, what?
Come on, man.
I'm trying. Defined by some Christian leaders as marriage between one man and one woman, precluding same-sex unions. Recent surveys by the Center, this is the Pew Center, find that most white evangelical Protestants, 63%, and half of black Protestants, 50%, continue to oppose legal same-sex marriage. So what can we draw from that? Well, the biggest question that was left unanswered is, how do you define the Bible? What are we talking about there? Are you talking about the laws regarding things like sins that would be worthy of the death penalty in Deuteronomy and Leviticus? Because if that's the Bible that you're referring to, I have a feeling that very few people would be interested in reviving those laws that were applicable in that place at that time, but they would not be applicable now. The survey never really specifies that. So if they maybe had narrowed it to say the New Testament, that might have been an interesting survey insofar as it would be more specific and it would eliminate, or it would screen out, I guess you could say, some of those questions about what about capital punishment in the Old Testament. What about patriarchs having many concubines and wives and maidservants and things like that? That's in the Bible, too. That's in the Old Testament. What about an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, the law of Talion? Remember, Jesus invoked that, and he invoked it in a negative way by saying, you know, you have read that it is an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, and he talks about loving your enemies and doing good to those who persecute you. So those are two biblical principles that are opposed to each other. It's not a contradiction on God's part, but rather that the time in which the law of Talion, the law of basically retaliating in kind against somebody who's done something to you, that became obsolete, and it was replaced by a better law, which is to have mercy and to show mercy on people, you see? So I find that interesting. Cyrus, if you had been part of that survey, what do you think you would have said in terms of an answer to that question, whether or not to have the Bible influence more the laws in this country?
I don't know. That's putting me on the spot.
I know.
I don't have an answer to this one.
That's why I did that.
Thanks. Yep. I need to think about this a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just say something off my
chest.
But
it's more fun when you do that.
I know you like it.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I'll go first. I would say, and if you don't want to, I can understand, but I would say, first of all, there's no way to avoid a biblical influence on our laws for some of the reasons that I just mentioned, the Ten Commandments being part of that. The whole idea of having care for the poor, I mean, that's a big part of the New Testament, a big part of the message of Jesus Christ. Take care of poor people. Now, you're not going to necessarily find that. You won't find that in all religions. You find them, I think, in most, but outside of the non-Christian religions, the Christian groups, they're going to be looking to the Bible for that, looking to the messages of Jesus for that. And I think that's a good influence, don't you? I mean, if you are using that, you're not doing it because Jesus said it, but being influenced by what he said.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think it's a good thing. So it just, to my mind, this doesn't really reveal very much because it doesn't clarify some of the underlying issues that I think if it had, could have made this a much more interesting survey. It would have been more meaningful in any case.
Yeah, the words of Jesus should influence us in how we do anything in our lives.
Absolutely. Let me play devil's advocate. Jesus said, and I believe this personally, but what about all the people out there who don't? Jesus said that in the beginning, God made them male and female. And this is what, you notice there's no third option. It's just the binary. And this is why he says a man leaves his father and mother and clings to his wife and the two become one flesh. And what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So he describes the institution of marriage as between one man and one woman. So we have two strikes against us right there on the gender ideology issue, because it's just men and women. And the second one is marriage is between one man and one woman. So you can see why in the minds of a certain segment of the population, Cyrus, and I think that segment is growing, in essence, Jesus' teaching here is considered by them to be hate speech.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's very sad.
Yeah, to say the least, it's very sad. So that's what we're up against, and I'm actually in a way surprised that the numbers were as high as they were. You know, as people have become conditioned to see anything that promotes traditional marriage, they see it as hate. They see it as an attack on people who don't fit into that category. It's not hate, and it's not an attack, but the fury on the left is implacable. And these are hot-button issues that they're not going to let go of, that's for sure. 888-914-9149. We have, in addition to an opportunity for you to call, we also have an opportunity for you to write to me and ask a question if you'd prefer to do it that way. The easiest way to do it is go to the show page, relevantradio.com, and then click on email, and you can send me an email that way. Here's one that comes in from Angie. She says, I'm a Cradle Catholic first-year law student at Regent University. I have a friend of mine who's Mormon and loves to compare Mormons to Catholics. I would love some advice on how to rebut the apostasy claim and the claim that Mormonism is the religion that makes the most logical sense. I have read resources and even listened to your debate, but I'm still struggling with it. Thank you. Any resources would be wonderful. Thank you, Angie. Well, I think what Angie's referring to is there are two debates that I did with two official members of the Mormon Church, and they were handpicked by the leadership in Salt Lake City. The first debate, I think, was in 1989. It was either 1989 or 1990 in Hacienda Heights, California. It was at St. John Vianney Catholic Church before it burned down, sadly. But it was actually in the hall. And I debated an ex-Catholic who had become Mormon. And he actually rose up rather high in the organization. He was in the First Quorum of the 70, which would be the level just below the 12 apostles. And he wasn't at that level when we had our debate, but he rose to that level subsequently. And so in that debate, we discussed the Mormon claim of that there are more than one God. So they believe in God the Father, or Heavenly Father, as they call him, also Jesus Christ as a God, also the Holy Ghost as a separate God. Now, they do claim as well that there are other gods out there, but we don't know anything about them. They claim that Heavenly Father was once a man on a planet near the star Kolob, and as a mortal man, he progressed to the point where his God judged him worthy of becoming a God. So that's how he is our God, because now we're his children, and the Mormon Church's teaching on eternal progression holds that people who do certain things, such as become Mormons and other activities that the Mormons enjoin upon them, that they can eventually reach that celestial kingdom and become gods themselves. And then the process just perpetuates that way. So that was the position that he defended. And I defended the teaching of one God in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And I think the second part of that debate was the great apostasy. Or maybe that was the first part, but the great apostasy claim was the other part of it, which is the Mormon Church's claim that shortly after Jesus established the church in the Holy Land, that after 100, 200 years, the weight of corruption and syncretism with false ideologies and pagan rituals and things, that basically collapsed the church. And there was a total apostasy, and there was no true church on the face of the earth until Joseph Smith, who purported to receive the restoration of the gospel, began the Mormon Church, or technically, officially, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. For that matter, there was also the bit in the Book of Mormon about how Jesus, after establishing the church in Israel, he went to the New World, somewhere maybe in Central America or Mexico, and he reestablished another church there, complete with the 12 apostles and the 70s and all that. And that church, too, failed under the weight of heresy and corruption. So Jesus, according to this, I mean, Mormons would not put it this way, but the reality is that he was a two-time loser because he didn't get it right twice. He said to the church that he established with Peter, James, and John, etc., he says, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. He says, you know, I will, behold, I am with you always, even until the end of the world, things like that. But apparently he either didn't know what he was talking about, or he couldn't prevent the apostasy from happening because the Mormons claimed that it did happen. So that one didn't work out. And then the second church that Jesus established, allegedly, that church also succumbed to apostasy. No matter how you slice it, it does not put Jesus in a good light. So that was the first debate. Then the second debate, a year or so later, the second gentleman was, I think he was a mission president, and he and I debated the Book of Mormon as one part of it. And then the second one was we debated whether or not the prophet of the Mormon Church could actually speak for God and give divine revelation. So if you've heard those, Angie, you've really actually heard quite a bit, and I'm sorry to hear that you're still unsure of what to say. But I've written a number of articles on the topic that are available for free, and they include articles on the topic of the apostasy. So the easiest way to get those is just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. You'll see on the upper left where it says links. Click that, and you'll see the links for the articles. And you can just simply download them. And I think that those are going to give you quite a bit more. Now, Catholic Answers back in the day, they published a very good book, and I do not understand why they let it go out of print. But for some strange reason, they let it go out of print. But it was called Inside Mormonism. And it's a rather thick tome, but it was written by a former Catholic priest by the name of Isaiah Bennett. You might be able to get a copy of this on the interwebs if you look. Maybe there is a used copy out there somewhere. But just really quickly, because we have to take a break, I'll just say that Isaiah Bennett was that Catholic priest who invited me. It was long about 1990. He invited me to go with one of my colleagues at Catholic Answers to his parish in New York City to do a seminar. And my part of the seminar was on Mormonism. And the reason was because he said that there were many Mormon missionaries active in his parish and members of his church were leaving and becoming Mormon. And so he wanted to kind of shore things up. So I went out there with my colleague. We spent the weekend and we put on these talks. I think my colleague was speaking about Jehovah's Witnesses. And then we went back to San Diego and I didn't really think anything of it. Had a nice meal with him after the conference was over, and it was pleasant. And he told me then about how he's super interested in Mormonism, and he was reading a lot and anything he could get his hands on because he was interested in apologetics with Mormons. So I get a call, you know, 2, 3 years later, 4 years later, probably 3 years later, maybe two. And it's from a Mormon guy that I knew in Los Angeles. And he's actually the one that set up these two debates that I did. I didn't set them up. He's the one that arranged them. So he calls me up and he says, "You'll never guess who came to speak at our Mormon church this past Sunday. Somebody that knows you or somebody who knows you." I said, "Really? Who's that?" He says, "Well, Isaiah Bennett." So the only Isaiah Bennett I know is a Catholic priest back east. Why would he come to your church to speak? He said, "Well, that's just it." I could hear the glee in his voice. He said, "That's just it. He's no longer a Catholic. He's no longer a priest. He's now a Mormon. He became a Mormon." And I was just flabbergasted. Like, how can that be? How can that possibly be? And I said, "Well, that's not going on my resume. You know, the priest brought me out there to help inoculate his people against the message of Mormonism. And what happens? The priest becomes Mormon. That doesn't look very good for me, does it?" So the Mormon fellow said, "Well, he wants you to call him. He'd like to talk to you." And he gave me his number and we hung up and I felt just terrible about this whole thing. And I think I've told the story before, but just briefly, here's what happened. So as I was getting ready to leave for the day, I was working at Catholic Answers at the time, and the phone kept ringing. And just somebody was trying to call me and I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was depressed. So I just let it keep going to voicemail. Monday morning, I found like 4 or 5 messages waiting for me, but I didn't get them because I didn't want to talk to anybody. So I told my wife, following day, I get out the piece of paper with Isaiah's phone number on it. He's living at that time up near Salt Lake City. And I called the number and I recognized his voice. And we had a somewhat tense conversation at first because he says, "Well, you weren't supposed to call me." I said, "I don't understand. This other guy, the Mormon guy, he called to tell me that you wanted to talk to me and he gave me your number." And he said, "Yeah, but I decided afterward that I really didn't want to because I didn't want to have a conflict with you. And I had told him to call you and tell you not to call me. In fact, that was the person who had kept calling me, but I didn't get the message. And it was God's providence that I didn't get the message because I wound up calling him and we had a conversation. And the most amazing thing happened in this conversation." Cyrus, we need to take a break, don't we?
We're getting close.
Yeah. So why don't we do this? We'll take a break and I will tell you when we return an amazing thing that happened. I mean, it was amazing. And probably not what you think when I talked to this ex-Catholic priest who had become a Mormon. I'll tell you what happened. I'll tell you the rest of the story when we return. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now.
You hear Cyrus scream in the background there? Little scream there. He's excited. I can't blame him. What a great job you have, Cyrus.
Best job in the world.
It is. It's great to be in the Beatles, isn't it?
So are you going to finish the story?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm going to finish the story.
All right.
So here's what happened. So let's turn the music down. I was on the phone with this ex-Catholic priest who had become Mormon. And if you're just tuning in right now, you're saying, what? You'll have to listen to the setup to get the backstory. But he's a priest that I knew, and he became so enthralled with studying about Mormonism that eventually he became a Mormon. And the guy who called me to say that he wanted me to give him a call tried to call me back later and said, don't call him because he's changed his mind. He doesn't want to talk to you. And it was too late because I didn't get the messages. So I called Isaiah that Saturday. And he was a bit tense at first, like, well, you weren't supposed to call me, and I didn't want to have a conflict with you, but here we are. So we wound up talking for about an hour. And by the end of that hour, I felt really even worse than I did at the beginning of the conversation because nothing I said had any effect on him. He was just as confident as you can imagine. And it was just a real failure for me. I took it pretty hard. And so that I just tried to put it out of my mind. That was the end of it. About 6 months go by, and he calls me back, and it was a Saturday, and he said, I really need to talk to you for a minute. I said, okay. I'm thinking, what does he want now? Is he going to try to have a shot at getting me to become Mormon? And he said, well, I want you to be the first to know, after, of course, my bishop and such, I want you to be the first to know that I've come back to the Catholic Church. Now, I had whiplash. Because he was a Catholic priest and he became a Mormon. Now he's back to the Catholic Church again. I said, what happened? He said, well, do you remember that conversation we had about 6 months ago? I said, yeah. It didn't go very well. He said, oh, it did, but you just didn't realize it. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, do you remember the question you asked me? No, I asked you 50 questions. I don't remember. And he says, well, the one question that you asked that really shook me was, Isaiah, you're a Catholic priest. How could you turn your back on Christ in the Eucharist? Now, even when he told me this, I didn't remember saying those words, but I did. I just didn't remember it. But he described how that was really, that was the arrow that penetrated his armor. And he did not want me to notice that. So he kept up the, the enthusiastic demeanor. But he said that when he hung up the phone after our conversation, he said that he noticed his hands were trembling because that comment that to me was just sort of a random comment. I didn't even remember saying it, but for him, it had a great shaking effect. It really, really rocked him. And he said he fought against it and he tried to put it out of his head, but he kept thinking about that. And he described how there was one instance where he was asleep in the middle of the night and he woke up and that question was ringing in his mind. I'm a Catholic priest. How could I turn my back on Christ in the Eucharist? Now, there were other things he described, other factors that were not directly involved with me, but all of it sort of coalesced to the point where he realized I made a big mistake. And so he renounced his affiliation with the Mormon Church. He went to his bishop and he was reconciled with the church. He made a good confession. Now, as you might imagine, he wasn't allowed to resume priestly ministry because of the public nature of his apostasy, etc. And there were other complicating factors, but the fact is he was back on board the ark. He was back in the church and back to the sacraments. And the reason I'm telling you this story is because he's the guy who wrote this book that I was recommending to the lady whose email I just read. Angie, I think her name is. She was looking for some assistance with a Mormon friend or colleague, somebody who's trying to get her to join the Mormon church. Well, I think that anybody who's in a situation like that should read this book by Isaiah Bennett. It's called Inside Mormonism. And the title of the book is very apt because he was inside Mormons. He went in and he not only became Mormon, but he also received the various ordinances that Mormons who receive a temple recommend and can go to the temple and participate in the endowment ceremonies and proxy baptisms and all the other things that go along with that. He was doing that for the few years that he was a Mormon. So he knew it from the inside, but he also knew his Catholic faith that he thankfully returned to. So what makes this book unique, especially for Catholics, it's written by somebody who actually knows from both sides of the equation what it's all about. And it includes his testimony, and he talks about what happened. So I know it's a kind of a long-winded answer, but it's important that you know that resources like this are available. And if Catholic Answers is listening, I love you guys, by the way. I'm a Catholic Answers alum, for those who don't know. I worked there for 8 years. But if Catholic Answers is listening, you know, unless there's some reason I don't know about, I wish you guys would bring that book back into print, because there are a lot of people who could really use it. Maybe you need an updated edition or something, but it's a very good resource, and I'd like to see it come back. Now, switching gears, some news that's just coming out now. Remember Bill Cosby? Remember the Bill Cosby Show? That was a great show, and my kids grew up on that show. Oh, Cyrus, you're fast. You were fast, Cyrus.
I loved this show.
It was a good show.
I loved it. Yep. Bill Cosby did so much. Man, what an awful, awful shame.
Heath Huxtable, right?
Yep.
Heath Huxtable.
And he was America's cool dad. He was America's dad.
Yeah, it was a very good program, and it was fun to watch. I enjoyed watching it. So that Bill Cosby, as you know, he went to jail because he was convicted of having done some really bad things with women. And he's in the news this morning because he had come up for parole, and his parole was denied. He's 83 years old. He's already served more than 2 years of his 3 to 10 year prison sentence for drugging and molesting one particular woman whom he met through the basketball program at his alma mater at Temple University. He had a parole hearing in the last several days, and the Pennsylvania Parole Board decided that Cosby had not yet met the requirements that warranted a release from prison. And there's a picture of him in this article. He's looking his age, I'll say that. He is smiling, though. So maybe he's had enough time to really deeply ponder his life, and perhaps there's going to be some good spiritual benefit to him. I pray that there will be. He also received a negative recommendation made by the Department of Corrections, and that at his next parole hearing, the board will review and consider whether he has successfully participated in and successfully completed a treatment program for sex offenders and violence prevention. Cosby must also receive a favorable recommendation for parole from the Department of Corrections, and the board will determine if he has maintained a clear conduct record for the duration of his incarceration. Reps for Cosby said in a statement obtained by Fox News on Thursday that news his parole has been denied by the Pennsylvania State Parole Board is not a surprise to Mr. Cosby, his family, or his friends, or his legal team. It was brought to our attention by Mr. Cosby that over the past months, members of the Pennsylvania State Parole Board had met with him and emphatically stated if he did not participate in the SVP, Sexual Violate Predator courses, that his parole would be denied. Mr. Cosby has vehemently proclaimed his innocence and continues to deny all allegations made against him as being false without the sheer evidence of any proof, the statement added. Today, Mr. Cosby continues to remain hopeful that the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court will issue an opinion to vacate his conviction or warrant him a new trial. He was accused of sexual assault by dozens of women, and he was deemed a sexually violent predator by his trial judge. He was convicted in 2018 and has been in prison ever since. So that's where things stand.
What a sad story. Sad story. Hey, you know, we've been getting some questions via Facebook. Is it okay if I ask one of these questions?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. This is, I have no idea how to spell her or say her name. It's TXNX. And she says, "Hi, Patrick. There are many consecrations to Mary formats available. Is there one that you prefer or recommend?"
I think very highly of the 33 Days to Morning Glory. I think that's been a very popular and inspiring way for people to prepare for consecrating themselves to Mary. So that would be one recommendation. When I was enrolled in the Brown Scapular of Our Lady of Mount Carmel and was consecrated to Our Lady as well as a child, I remember fondly doing that, and I've always had a fondness for that version. So that might be another one to check out. Maybe I'll leave it at that. Those are two really good ones. And I think you can't go wrong, honestly. If you ask Our Lady to protect you in a special way and you entrust yourself to her intercession, you're going to have a much happier life than you would if you didn't ask for her help.
Oh, thanks. Okay. Yeah. Oh, and this just came in from Maureen on Twitter.
Okay.
She tells me, she says, tell Patrick Isaiah Bennett's book is selling for, take a guess, how much on Amazon? Just take a quick guess.
As a rare used copy, I don't know, $500?
$161 on Amazon. Oh, and she then says, I hope Catholic Answers is listening.
Yeah, me too. Come on, guys, get that book back in print. All right, we have another hour to go, but it's going to go quickly. And if you'd like to be on the air with your question, just call me at this number, 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Plenty ahead right after this, so please stay right there.